VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Mario Ritter Jr. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
the large Itaipu Dam between Paraguay and Brazil is facing an energy production crisis because of record low river and rainfall levels. Experts say those low levels could last into 2022. The Itaipu Dam supplies about 10% of the energy used in Brazil and 86% of energy used in Paraguay. The dam has recorded its lowest energy production levels since it began full operation in 2005. Hugo Zarate is head of operations at the Itaipu Dam. He told Reuters, "We have available power. What we don't have is water to sustain that power for a long time." He added that the dam was meeting the demand, but for short periods of time. Zarate estimated that energy production at Itaipu would be between 65,000 and 67,000 gigawatt hours this year. That's about 35% of the maximum value of 2016 and 15% less than in 2020, he said. The low levels affected both power production and the money the countries receive for the use of the water. The drought, or severe lack of water, is one of the worst in the last 100 years. Brazil's government has asked its citizens to reduce their use of electricity and water. The drought has also affected production at the Yacyretá Dam between Paraguay and Argentina. Yacyretá produced half the normal level of energy in September. Both dams depend on the flow of the Paraná River and have limited ability to store water. River flow is controlled by about 50 dams in Brazil. Those dams have seen water stores decrease since 2019 because of lower rainfall levels. Workers at Itaipu say the dam normally averages an inflow of about 11,000 cubic meters per second. Yacyretá workers say that dam normally averages about 14,500 cubic meters per second. So far this year, the average flow in Itaipu is 6,800 cubic meters per second. Zarate says that is similar to levels in the 1970s. Average monthly inflows for Yacyretá are between 6,000 to 9,500 cubic meters per second, said Lucas Chamorro. He is the dam's head of water studies. Weather expert Isaac Henkes says below normal rainfall seems likely for southern Brazil for the rest of the year. Plenty more rain is needed to ease drought concerns, he said. Zarate said the Itaipu Dam totally relies on the improvement of the water flows. He added that if water flow does not improve, the energy crisis will continue into 2022.
Thank you. The United Nations has warned that Afghanistan is facing a massive food crisis. It urged the international community to act quickly to increase levels of humanitarian aid to help the people. The director of the UN's World Food Program, David Beasley, said millions of Afghans could die of starvation unless immediate action is taken to provide assistance. Beasley told Reuters an estimated 23 million people currently face severe food insecurity and were marching to starvation. This compares to 14 million people who were facing the same situation just 2 months ago. Children are going to die. People are going to starve, Beasley said. Things are going to get a lot worse. He added, I don't know how you don't have millions of people, and especially children, dying at the rate we are going with the lack of funding and the collapsing of the economy. Afghanistan's economic situation worsened in August after Taliban fighters drove out the country's Western-backed government and seized power. The Taliban takeover led many international donors to hold back billions of dollars in assistance. The food crisis has worsened because of the effects of climate change. It was severe even before the Taliban took over the government. Now the Taliban is blocked from accessing money and property held outside the country by nations still deciding how to deal with the Taliban government. Beasley said that money already meant for development assistance should be repurposed for humanitarian aid. Some countries have already redirected aid in this way. Beasley added that money frozen by other nations could be released through UN agencies. You've got to unfreeze these funds so people can survive, he said. UN officials have said the World Food Program needs up to $220 million a month to partly feed the millions of Afghans facing food insecurity as winter nears. Economic problems have led many Afghans to sell personal belongings to pay for food, Reuters reported. The latest food crisis has hit both cities and rural areas. Aid groups have urged countries that are concerned about human rights under the Taliban to start negotiations with the new rulers before the situation gets worse. Beasley said a total economic collapse in Afghanistan could create a massive refugee flow similar to the 2015 migration crisis from Syria into Europe. I don't think the leaders in the world realize what is coming their way, Beasley said. When asked about the country's humanitarian crisis, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid told Agence France-Presse on Sunday, We are trying to get our people out of the current situation and help them. He added that humanitarian aid has also arrived. I'm Brian Lynn.
A group of health experts says Older adults without heart disease should not take aspirin to prevent a heart attack or stroke. The group says the risk of bleeding inside the body for people 60 years of age and older is greater than the protection from heart disease. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released an early version of the new guidance recently. It is a government-appointed group of health experts on disease prevention. In addition to advice for older adults, the group for the first time said there may be a small benefit for adults in their 40s who have no bleeding risks. The experts also said there is less clear evidence of a benefit for those in their 50s. The group's guidelines are meant for people who are at higher risk of heart disease. This includes people with high blood pressure, high cholesterol, those who are highly overweight, or who have conditions that increase their chances for a heart attack or stroke. Anyone considering whether to start or stop the aspirin treatment should talk with a doctor first, the group also advised. Aspirin use can cause serious harms and risk increases with age, said John Wong, a group member and doctor at Tufts Medical Center in Boston. In 2016, the prevention experts had advised that a small amount of aspirin each day could help prevent a first heart attack or stroke. The new advice is in agreement with more recent guidelines from other medical groups. Doctors have long advised small amounts of aspirin every day for many patients who already have had a heart attack or stroke. The group's guidance does not change that. The new guidance was announced online to let the public comment on it until November 8th. The group will study the comments and then make a final decision. Wong said the guidelines are being updated because of new studies and re-examination of older research. Aspirin is best known as a medicine to reduce pain, but it also thins blood. This can reduce the chances for blood clots. But aspirin also has risks, even in small amounts. These include bleeding in the stomach or intestines and ulcers. Both conditions can be dangerous. Dr. Lauren Block is a researcher at the Feinstein Institutes for Medical Research in Manhasset, New York. She said the guidance is important because so many adults take aspirin although they have never had a heart attack or stroke. Block is not on the task force. However, she recently stopped treating a patient with aspirin because of the possible bad effects. She instead began treating the patient with a cholesterol-lowering drug known as a statin. The patient is 70-year-old Richard Schraffel. He has high blood pressure and knows about his heart attack risks. Schraffel said he never had bad effects from aspirin, but he takes the new guidance seriously. 63-year-old Rita Seefelt also has high blood pressure. She took aspirin every day for about 10 years, until her doctor told her to stop 2 years ago. He said they changed their minds on that, remembered the retired elementary school teacher from Milwaukee. She said she understands that science develops over time. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked, or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The attorney general said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claim to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The president finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent, He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression, and he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. "If there is," he said, "then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time."
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.